My work often has this very deep, deep investigation into history. I mean, I love books, I love reading, I love the information, I love documentaries. And so it all becomes source material. I almost think of it as an iceberg, that the audience might just see the little tip, but what informs that tip is this amazing depth of information. So it allows for a lot of understanding for both myself and the performers of knowing, okay, where are we coming from and why? Like, we're not just creating it because we want to be fabulous or create something fabulous, but we're creating it to also impart an idea, and that idea is rooted in a history and a culture.
You're listening to The Rhythm of Rebellion with Taina Asili. Welcome to another episode of The Rhythm of Rebellion. I'm your host, Taina Asili, and today we have the immense pleasure of diving into the world of art, dance, and activism with a truly remarkable guest. Hailing from the vibrant cultural tapestry of Brooklyn, New York, Edissa Weeks is a choreographer, educator, and the visionary director of Delirious Dances. Her work is a mesmerizing blend of theater and dance, creating intimate environments that have been celebrated for their striking visual effects and thought-provoking narratives. Edissa's performances have graced a wide array of venues, from Harlem Stage to the Kennedy Center, from the Guggenheim Museum to living rooms in Berlin, Germany. She is a storyteller, a dancer, and a creator who invites us to explore the complexities of the human experience through her art. Raised in diverse settings such as Uganda, Papua New Guinea, and her beloved Brooklyn, Edissa's journey as an artist and educator has been nothing short of remarkable. Edissa and I first crossed paths when she brought me on as a composer for Action Songs Protest Dances, a groundbreaking collaboration that came to life at the Kupferberg Center for the Performing Arts in November of 2022. This incredible performance featured myself as well as composer-performers Spirit Paris McIntyre and Martha Redbone, who have both been on previous episodes of The Rhythm of Rebellion, and of course, the visionary choreography of Edissa Weeks performed by Delirious Dances. Today, we have the privilege of delving into her artistic journey, the power of dance as a form of rebellion, and her latest work, Three Rights, a captivating three-part series exploration of the African-American experience in America. Hi, Edissa. Welcome to The Rhythm of Rebellion. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be here, Taina. It's such an amazing community that you have created through this podcast series.
Thank you. I know that we have a lot of community in common, including my last guest that I had on the show, Morley. And it's amazing that it's only been in the past, I guess, few years that you and I have met, because it feels like we are immersed in similar worlds. I'm so grateful that you brought me on to work with you as a composer on the last project that we did together, because it has been such a beautiful opportunity to get to know your work more closely. And I'm excited to share that with our listeners today. But you know what I don't know a lot about you is your early years, that early time period of your life. And for myself, I'm really excited to kind of explore that. So I wanted to know more about that personal journey, how your unique upbringing spanning Uganda, Papua New Guinea, and Brooklyn, how that has influenced your artistic vision and your approach to dance and storytelling.
Oh, there's so much to cover, because each of those countries and different continents are so rich. So my mother is from Uganda, East Africa, and my father is white American, going back to Scotland. Actually met in Uganda. Dad was doing some research on comparative education. He was working on his dissertation there, and so they came back to the States to finish his dissertation, and mom came with him, and they got married, and then they had my brother and I. And so when I was three, we actually moved back to Uganda for dad to finish his research. And my first memories are in Uganda. And I would say that, because I just went back, my mother passed in 2020. She had gallbladder cancer, and because we were in the pandemic, I wasn't able to take her ashes back. And so this past summer, I finally was able to take her ashes back. And I hadn't been in Uganda since 1996.
Wow.
And so it was just so moving. But one of the things that I realize I treasure and has greatly influenced me as an artist is the importance of food.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel in a lot of my work, food is integrated, because I find food can be such an amazing way of bringing people together, because we all need to eat.
Yes.
And you don't want people to go hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And to be a good host, you feed people.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if like all I have is one slice of orange, we're going to like cut up that orange so everybody can have like a piece of it. You know? And that sense of generosity that when you went to visit someone, because there's a lot of people to visit, a lot of people that I hadn't seen since the 90s or since I was a little kid. But it felt like I'd always been there.
Yeah.
And so that beauty of community and just picking up. And so I think that sort of generosity of gifting is something that has really influenced my work, because in a lot of what I create, it's that idea of how do I give a gift and seeing art as a form of gift giving.
Oh, wow.
So it's not really about me, but it's about how we together can create something amazing.
Mm.
The influence that my father had in my life is that he wasn't a very emotional person. However, he was wonderful in really exposing myself and my siblings to so much art. As much as possible, he would also include us on his trips, because he was in, as I mentioned, comparative education and Papua New Guinea. He actually started the education department at the university, and he was doing a lot of research on how to improve the educational system in Papua New Guinea, teacher training, like what areas needed to focus on in terms of if you didn't pass your 8th or 9th or 10th grade forms, you didn't continue education. But then if you went back to the village, you didn't necessarily have a skill or been disconnected from a lot of those people. So Dad started a program providing vocational training.
Mm.
So if people went back to school, they would have some experience in, say, working on a farm or working in a car, repair place, or how do you build a chicken coop? And so he'd often take us on these journeys. And one of the things that was amazing being in Papua New Guinea, and especially in the highlands, was Sing Sings.
Mm.
And there are these big performative events that often would happen across villages and across communities where, again, food was a big part of it, but singing and dance was also a part of it. So instead of fighting each other and killing each other, how can we find peace through music and through exchange? And I will never forget seeing the mud men come out of the bushes, and you know, they were covered in like this white mud, and then they had these huge masks that covered their faces, and they moved very silently and mysteriously, and it made me realize the importance of ritual in connecting people.
Okay.
And I think that was a long-winded way of saying that ritual, and how do we create these rituals of engagement? And so I'm really interested in creating worlds where it's not just about watching me be fabulous as a performer, but how can the audience also be fabulous? How can I also recognize the audience in my process? And how can we together, for the moment that we are sharing space together, create a world?
I want to ask you more about this idea of gift giving and ritual. Can you elaborate more on the creative process for that? Some inspirations that come up for you that drive your unique choreographic style?
A lot of it is invested in research. One of my teachers and mentors was George Bass. And George Bass had been the personal secretary of Langston Hughes. And he really emphasized the research to performance practice of creating work.
Mm-hmm.
So how can the work be rooted in historical fact, but also cultural traditions? And that we don't exist in a vacuum. So what are the various influences that existed within a time period that you're focusing on the work, but then also how do you, as an artist, bring your own thoughts and ideas to this stew that you're creating, going back to a food metaphor. And so my work often has this very deep, deep investigation into history. I mean, I love books. I love reading. I love the information. I love documentaries. And so it all becomes source material. I almost think of it as an iceberg, that the audience might just see the little tip, but what informs that tip is this amazing depth of information. So it allows for a lot of understanding from both myself and the performers of knowing, okay, where are we coming from and why? Like, we're not just creating it to because we want to be fabulous or create something fabulous, but we're creating it to also impart an idea. And that idea is rooted in a history and a culture. Mm-hmm. So I think it starts with research. A lot of my process is very slow. Sort of like a unveiling and revealing in the process. I love working collaboratively. I mean, ultimately, I take responsibility for the choices, but I'm very interested in what everybody brings to the process so everyone can be seen and everyone has a stake in what's being shared. As part of that, improvisation is a big part of both the creative process and also part of the structure of a work. Like, I love having structured improvisations because then the performers can't just go on automatic. They have to respond in real time to what is happening.
Right.
I think also because I'm drawing from so many, like having a mother from Uganda and having a father who's a white American going back to Scotland, that there's a lot of melting and mixture happening in me. I'm also the middle child. So I think that was also part of it, of like, how do I like mediate between like my younger siblings and my older siblings? Like, I'm one of the shortest in my family. So everyone is like pretty tall. So I always got stuck in the middle chair when we were ever in the car driving. So my art is also about mediation and the mediation of ideas. And sometimes those ideas are very painful. And so if we're going to go to a place of pain, by that I mean the trauma of enslavement, or I did a piece about postpartum depression. So how do we go there safely and also find ways to come out? And so that for me is also part of the ritual.
I know that you utilized a lot of these tools in the work that we did together with Action Songs Protest Dances in relationship to the research that you did around James Forman. And I was just wondering if you could share a little bit more about that process.
When I started teaching at Queen's College, it was in 2010, and that same year, Queen's College acquired the James Forman archives. His main archives are in the Smithsonian, and whatever the Smithsonian didn't take, went to Queen's College, which also included his FBI files, which was really fascinating for me. James Forman was the first person who I heard be very critical of capitalism. And I remember being shocked. Because as a young person, I grew up playing Monopoly, and it was like, you know, so much of it was like, capitalism is good for us. And he was the first person who was like, no, capitalism is actually pitting us against each other. It's about benefiting the few, but not the many. I became really interested in how to know more about James Forman. And then also realizing that a lot of people didn't know who he was and his significance to the civil rights movement and the voting rights campaigns that were happening in Mississippi and other parts of the South, that he was front and center in a lot of that movement, especially with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 1960s. Part of why I feel he didn't become more well-known is that he really advocated for lateral leadership, that he didn't believe in having a charismatic leader, because once you remove the charismatic leader, you often destroy the movement. So how can we empower everyone to be leaders in their own right? And so he didn't really put himself forward as like, I'm someone you need to follow, because it would have been against what his ethos was. So I was very interested in, you know, how do we uplift the ideals that James Forman advocated for. Mm-hmm. And knowing that his archives were at Queen's College, it gave me a reason to kind of do a deep dive into them. So part of the process was developing a dossier of information about James Forman, because I realized that it wasn't just me. There were a lot of other people in the cast who were not familiar with his work. You know, included quotes, some of his writing. And for me, it was also, again, part of the collaborative process, knowing that I was working with both you and Martha Redbone and Spirit McIntyre, because we were in the midst of the pandemic, and knowing that we couldn't rehearse in person, how can we use Zoom as a way of connecting? And as part of that, each of you were connected with two dancers. And so the thought that to write a song that also resonated with what the dancers were thinking about and what they were working on and what they were passionate about. So again, wasn't just an imposing my thoughts or my ideas on them, but how can they be integral to the process of creating both the song and the movement? And I'm so grateful that you were open to that process, Taina.
Oh, I love that process. You know, I too use a lot of research. You know, I love this metaphor that you talked about around the iceberg. And so many people have no idea the amount of research that goes into creating the songs that I create. Just hours and hours and hours of reading and listening. And I appreciate when artists use that particular method. And I loved receiving that dossier from you and diving into information around James Forman, because I didn't know about his life and this story. So for me, it was really interesting and affirming that anti-capitalist perspective, and also understanding his perspective as it relates to reparations and what that meant to him, which was the song that I worked on with you. I mean, it was just so informative for myself, and it has inspired not only the work that I did with you, but, you know, as artists, this work then comes with us into our other creative endeavors. Speaking of other creative endeavors, I know that you have a new series of shows that you've been working on called Three Rights. And I wanted to see if you could talk to us about the inspiration behind this work and what you aim to convey through its intricate storytelling and dance elements.
Rewrite started because I became fascinated with why life, liberty, and happiness were included in the Declaration as inalienable rights that we are guaranteed. And, you know, I grew up going, I have life, liberty, and happiness, but then going, ooh, actually, how do you guarantee life? How do you guarantee happiness? And who did they guarantee it for in the 1700s when this document was written? And how do you guarantee it now? Especially when I think of DACA and Black Lives Matter, and that we've been continuously at war in the Middle East, you know, just, you know, how do we uphold these rights for everyone and not just in theory?
Right.
So I wanted to do a deep dive into life, liberty, and happiness. And so life looks at how we can be better stewards of the world, and specifically focusing on our dependence on fossil fuels and then plastic that is made from fossil fuels, because feeling that that is killing us, whether it's through war or through microplastics that we are now ingesting, and how is that connected to cancer and other diseases that are happening, and also environmental warming, how is it connected to that? And so as part of the Life Right, it's a huge installation of plastic waste. I've been collecting plastic waste for like four years. Initially, I was collecting it from my neighbors, because I was like, oh, I can get a lot of like plastic on you know, recycling days. But then I was finding way too much about my neighbors. So I was like, I have to stop that.
Where did you store all this plastic?
Initially it was like, I'm looking around because there used to be like huge bags of plastic here. I actually had to get a storage unit. To store all the plastic that we were collecting. Because I really wanted the dancers and the audience to be wading through plastic, you know, because I feel often, we just throw it out. Someone takes it away and we don't think about where it's going. And we don't think of the people who have to then sort through it. And the really horrifying fact that only, I think it's like about 8% of plastic is actually recycled. you know, the majority of it ends up in landfills and ends up in other countries. And again, all the health problems that are connected to it.
Absolutely.
And there are alternatives. We can be making plastic out of mushroom roots or mm-hmm. out of seaweed and algae. I mean, there are tons of alternatives, but we need to have the power and the mindset to advocate for that change.
Right.
So that right is really about having a radical revolution of values. How do we change what we value?
Yes.
And as part of that, it's having discussions in what we're calling the green room. And so one of the discussions we had was about the Buen Vivir movement, which actually started in Ecuador, which is about changing how a country defines its success. So instead of it being based on the gross domestic product, which is connected to corporations,
right,
can it instead be based on how many of your citizens are living above the poverty line, have access to healthcare, to housing, to education, to food? Like, if your people are happy, that should be what determines a nation's success. So that's just life.
Woo! That's just one of three. That's just one of three. Okay. Yep. All right. So this is a journey. Ooh, I love it.
It is. Liberty is looking at the pathologizing of African Americans by psychiatry and the foundations of liberty in America. So as part of that right, I've been in the process of making 1,865 roots out of paper and twine. And the thought is that the audience walks through these roots on their way to meet the Liberty character. And the roots are anywhere from like 8 to 30 feet long. Oh. And for me, you're going into the underbelly of American history by walking through these roots. As the Liberty character, it's a solo for myself. I start in whiteface, and then as part of the piece, I transfer into blackface. And I also tell stories as part of the work. Because one of the things that was fascinating for me is realizing that we are like 99% the same, if you look at our gene structure. Mm-hmm. But we are taught to hate each other. And anything that was taught, anything that was done, can be undone. And just really looking at a lot of the histories and the laws in America where they were used as a way to undermine Black people and to keep them in a place of subservience, meaning that there was an actual psychiatric disorder called negritude. And what happened in that disorder is that if you're around Black people, your skin would get darker, you would become more violent and more sexualized. And there's another one, drapedomania. And again, this isn't a psychiatric book that people read and learned from. Drapedomania was like flight from home syndrome. And it's for people who ran away from enslavement. And the cure for it was whipping a person. So really looking at, where do our biases come from? How do they begin? How do they now inform our policing and our practices? And if they were done, they can be undone. So for me, the liberty right is a right of undoing. The happiness right is about joy. Yeah, it's really about tapping into self-care. It was really fascinating for me to realize that initially it was supposed to be life, liberty, and property. And property got turned into happiness. And part of it was that back in 1700s, the only people who could vote were people who owned property. And they weren't really interested in everybody voting. It was also that enslaved people were property. And so if you're guaranteeing people to property, were you guaranteeing that they could keep enslaved people in perpetuity? So there are several reasons why it was changed to happiness. Thomas Jefferson, who was one of the main writers, was a big fan of enlightenment. And so the whole idea of happiness as being an aspiration for people. But with a lot of the research I was doing, it was finding out that the pursuit of happiness actually stresses people out. That what makes the average person happy, I mean, there's always exceptions, but what makes the average person happy is having a meal, you know, sitting down and sharing a meal with people, you know, doing what we're doing right now, just talking and shooting the breeze.
Yeah.
Volunteering is a big one, where you see that you can make a difference in a situation or another person's life. So I really wanted to create a right that was about tapping into joy as a form of empowerment and resistance against oppression, and joy as a way of developing the resiliency so that we have the strength to uphold life, liberty, and happiness for all.
And is this show ongoing? I know that you've done several performances already. Is there a way for audiences to still interact with these pieces?
Yes. So we were only able to do a version of Life this past September. And so the full version will premiere in 2025. Okay. We're talking with Snug Harbor Cultural Center on Staten Island. I love, 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 love that facility. It's actually where we started, one of the places where we started working on the right. Liberty, I'm touring to Washington, D.C. in March and then Pittsburgh in April.
Wow.
And the Happiness right now, we're not scheduled to perform anywhere. Hopefully. Who knows?
Hopefully. I wanted to just circle back a bit to your work as an educator. Mm. I know you've taught at various institutions, sharing your passion for choreography. And I was wondering how you see your role of dance and the arts in empowering, inspiring the next generation of artists and activists.
For me, teaching is a lot about listening, and that I'm not the only person with information in the room. Bell Hooks has been a huge inspiration for me. I love one of her books, Teaching to Transgress, which is really about how do we listen and also engage and encourage conversation. Too often, education just becomes about learn these facts, be able to spit them out, and then you'll get an A. As opposed to, okay, there are these facts, but what do you think about them? How do they inform us? Are they good for us? Do we need to rethink them in some level in terms of the behavior patterns that they generated? So how do you use education as a way to create dialogue? And also, how do I use education and my teaching practice as a way to nurture the individual? And this is hard. It takes time.
Yes.
It's much easier to just have the multiple choice, pick A, B, and C. It's much harder to be like, okay, how do you think? Why do you think that way? So for me, teaching is about supporting the individual in their journey and what their journey is. And that's why I started with listening. Yeah. How do I listen to who you are and then try and support that individual and what they're trying to achieve? And what I love is when I can introduce ideas and other possibilities, and then you see the light bulbs go off. Mm-hmm. And when someone came in with just a very safe way of doing things, and then by the end, they're willing to take creative risks. Mm. I'm much more interested in the process. Like, how did you get there? Yeah. Why did you make that choice?
Yeah.
Someone may make this huge leap of understanding, but because they're just starting, they might not make the most amazing work, but the journey that they went on was phenomenal.
Mm.
Compared to somebody who already had a lot of information, but then they just stay there. They're just riding on what they know as opposed to really challenging themselves to grow. And I'm interested in the growth. I'm interested in the process.
Yes. Edissa, are there any challenges that you have faced as an artist? And how have these challenges or triumphs shaped your artistic and activist journey?
Oh, there's so many. One of it is realizing that not everybody's going to like what you do.
Mm.
And so having the confidence to just be like, these are the questions I'm asking. This is how I'm solving it. And I'm going to do it because this is what I care about. This is what I'm interested in. And that can be very, very hard in a I want to be liked environment, which I feel like we're in very much right now. Like me, like me.
Oh, so real.
And it's knowing that, why am I doing what I'm doing? And am I doing it to please other people? Or am I doing it because this is what I'm passionate about? And knowing that, okay, that might mean that you're not going to become famous, or you might not become a household name. And going, that's okay, because I'm doing what I care about and what to me is meaningful.
Mm.
So that was something that was a real challenge that I had to kind of learn to understand about where my work is in the world. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I saw my mother give up her dreams, partially because she was a single mom, had two kids to feed, and that reality of being a Black woman textile designer in the 1970s and 80s, when there was not really a space for a Black woman textile designer. And so I'm super grateful for her because she always encouraged me to pursue my dreams. But one of that, I think, because I saw so much about my mom let go, it was my choice to not have children. And there's a little sadness in that, but in some ways it's the journey that I have chosen to embrace. And so in many ways, my students become my children. Other challenges, oh my God, is funding.
Talk about
it. It's a
it.
Big part, especially when I want to work with other people. I mean, for a long time, I was a solo duet company. Yeah. Just because, if I didn't pay myself, I wasn't paying myself. but as part of that, it enabled me to develop a track record of people who saw the work that I was doing, appreciated it, and so that now I'm at a stage where I can get those grants to support the work. But it was, living on rice and beans, and I had other friends who were like buying houses and, doing stuff. And it was like, well, I'm still doing my dance thing. And but then I've also seen some of them are in jobs that they don't enjoy, where I've been able to pursue my passion. And now I'm in a place where my passion is actually enabling me to make a living. But again, it's like that yin yang, their gives and takes.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is my pathway. It's not everybody's pathway, but it's the pathway that I did. One of the works I did when I was getting really frustrated because I felt like presenters were not picking up what I was doing. And so I was like, I'm going to do a piece and perform in people's living rooms.
Yes.
Because while there are X number of theaters, there are XXXX numerous number of homes that people are living in. And so I just called up a bunch of my friends and said, I'm doing this performance. Can we perform in your living room? And thankfully, many people said yes. And then it spread by word of mouth. And so for me, it was a way of kind of like getting around the whole presenter thing and having needing to have a presenter accept me or sanction the work. As part of that piece, I was really interested going into senior centers and into hospitals. It was called Liaisons, and I called it more interior specific as opposed to site specific, because we would have to go into someone's home and just figure out, okay, how can we do this performance for four dancers inside someone's home? And then I'm deeply grateful for André Lepecki, because he invited me to bring the work to Berlin. And I didn't know anyone in Berlin. So I was like, André, how am I going to find homes? And he was like, we brainstormed. And so we basically decided that I would go up to people in the street and be like, hi, my name's Edissa Weeks. Can I dance in your living room?
What? Are you serious?
I talked to probably about like 120 people.
Wow.
The goal was to find four homes to perform in.
That's awesome.
I found four homes. But yeah, it took a lot of talking to people and being like, you don't know me, but will you let us dance in your living room? So it's really about being able to think outside of paradigms. Now, they're just the challenges that come out there because you're putting yourself out in the line. I mean, there's a possibility that I wouldn't have found anybody. Yeah. I found the best place to talk to people was by the library and in the park. And that's where we got the four people to make a commitment.
I love the creativity that you put into, if this door is locked, I'm going to go around the back. I'm going to climb through the window. And I think that that's a big piece of our work that we don't talk about enough, especially those of us as artists who are doing work outside of the mainstream, that are speaking about issues that many venues are not interested in lifting up. So I love the creative approach. It really resonates with me right now. I'm actually working with a choreographer on a new piece and thinking about spaces where we're going to perform this piece locally, and really struggling, even still as an artist doing this for a couple decades at least, you know, finding spaces that are ready and waiting and in alignment to receive this work is tricky. You know, you spoke about believing in yourself even when no one else believes in that work or likes that work. And you spoke about this trust and like that taking risk and knowing when to do that. And I was curious about how you find that.
Taina, this is going to sound corny, but it's leading with love and it's leading with trust. We're in a world that tends to be like, oh, that's corny, or that's, you're soft and you want to be hard. But love to me is hard. It's saying that you're willing to be vulnerable and you're willing to take in other people into consideration and bring them into your world. And it's opening yourself up for rejection. So I can have this tough hardness, but then it's like brittle. You're clashing against other brittleness and other hardness. And for me, it's like, how can you be rooted in who you are, but be able to bend? If someone doesn't accept you, it's not trying to fight and prove to them that they need to accept you. And so I feel that often happens, that it's like, I want this person to like me and respect me and to acknowledge me. And so I keep going after that.
Yeah.
But then you're missing all the other people who might be out there who do understand what you're doing and will accept it. It's about, what are your values? What do I care about? And how do I support that? And again, this is my journey and my value structure. It's very easy to put people into boxes. However, I feel like some people might be a box, that other person might be a circle. This person might have a shape that doesn't even have a name. And so how can we see people for who they are? And that, to me, that's part of what's challenging and hard. I'm not always great at it, but it's what I strive for. And for me, that's also part of the gift giving, that when I am doing a performance, yes, I'm the one performing it, but how can this performance be a gift? Whoever is in the audience is choosing to be here. There's so many other places that they could have been.
Yeah.
So in this moment, how can this performance, this journey that we're going on together, be a shared gift?
Elisa, I want to thank you for the gifts that you give to this world. I want to thank you for the gift of being on this show today and sharing your practice, sharing your wisdom. I hope it inspires many others on this path. And I look forward to many more opportunities to work with you.
Oh, I am so holding you in love and respect, Taina. Martha Redbone described you as a tree. And I would say you are an incredible tree. And that what was fascinating for me is realizing that trees also communicate and support each other through their roots. Mm. And you have created this incredibly beautiful, beautiful root system that is not always visible. And I have so much respect for your leadership and how you give abundantly.
Thank you so much for that. I receive that with gratitude. Take care, Elisa.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on this insightful journey into the world of dance and activism with Edissa Weeks. Her unique perspective and powerful storytelling through movement remind us of the boundless possibilities within the world of performing arts and rebellion. You can stay connected with Edissa Weeks and her work at deliriousdances.com or at deliriousdances on Instagram. I'm your host, Taina Seely. You can keep up with my work on Instagram and YouTube at Taina Seely, on Facebook at Taina Seely Music, or on my website, tainaaseely.com. All of these links will be shared in the show notes. Many thanks to our editor, Moses Nagel, and Sina Basila Hickey at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and leave your thoughts about the podcast. Your feedback is invaluable and helps us to continue to bring these thought-provoking conversations. Until next time, peace, love, and liberation.